We welcome everybody really to our ongoing series that we started back in 2008, I believe, on great rabbinic thinkers. So, Bakasha, a pleasure to see everybody. And Dr. Mark, it's all yours.
Yes, hi. In fact, I think I had the idea of doing the classes on Ramoliver last year, Shavuos. Here you got the Mizrahi magazine, you know, if you don't have Misha Beirachs, when are you supposed to read it? So we have Misha Beirachs. They brought them all back. So there's plenty of time between Aliyahs. And Shavuos of 5783, there's three articles here. In fact, here's the lead one. Rav Shmuel Moliver, what does it say? Commemorating the 120th anniversary of the forerunner of the Mizrahi movement. And there's some pictures and two other articles. So I thought that we did Rav Rinas. And we did the Nesiv, so we should do Rav Shmuel Moliver. And Thomas, you ask how Gan Shmuel, the Shomer HaTzair Kibbutz, got its name from Rabbi Moliver. Well, we will get to that. As my old teacher, Rabbi Kaffet, would say, you know, he says we can have Savlonitis. We have to Savlonut. We'll get to it. Now, Rav Moliver's significance is that he's the outstanding leader of Chovei Tzion, and he had a great impact in spreading the Zionist idea. We will see political Zionism, not just the idea of settling in the land of Israel. Both, actually, I should say. Yeah, his dates are 1824 and 1898, so let's pick up. He's born in 1824 in Lita, in the Vilna district, a little town I hadn't heard of called Holubka. If you just read the traditional biographies, they tell you about his ichos. His father was a scholar. His grandfather was a scholar. Not communal rabbis, but scholars. They say that his father only became a rabbi at the end of his life when he lost all his money. So he had to become a rav. There's actually a legend told about, how do I know anything about Rav Moliver? There's a number of biographies that are written after his death, and the longest one really was written in the 50s. I guess it's the 50s, but he wrote pieces of it earlier, by Rabbi Yehuda Leib Maimon, the early Mizrahi leader. Now, the problem with Rabbi Maimon is that he has all these stories. He has like six volumes. Every month they have, you know, every month, you know, it says stories put together. He'd come out with them in Sinai, in the journal he edited. And they're full of Bubba Maisas, and they're full of stories that aren't true. So you have to take them all with a grain of salt. He did not know, maybe in his youth he had met Rav Moliver, but it's not like he knew him personally. But often, as we say, the stories are just as interesting sometimes as the real things. Well, Rav Maimon published the Tshuvos. First, they published early on the Tshuvos of Rav Moliver, and then there's another edition which has his biography. It's called Tshuvot Maharash Moliver, and there's like a 70-page biography in there, which, again, you have to distinguish the hagiography from the factual stuff, but looking in terms of the hagiography, if you look on page 14, we have a nice story here, which it tells us that when already, all these rabbis, these Gedolim, were supposed to have stories, hagiographical stories. But when he was a young lad, 6 or 7 years old in Cheder, they're in school and they're learning Parshas Chaye Sara, right around our season of the year. And we're Vayera. So what's the question? It says the Rebbe asked the question. One of the students, asked the Rebbe, why does the Torah go into such detail? You'll remember this actually. When we get to the Chaye Sara, I think you'll remember this. You know, buying the field from Ephron, like who cares? And it tells him how many shekels he paid to buy it. What's that all about? And as the Melamed, so we're told the story. Obviously, this is a story that was created afterwards. I'm sure it never happened, but it could have happened. So while the Melamed is thinking of an answer, young little Shmuel calls out and says that the Torah is coming to tell us that when we need to redeem, I guess you would say, land in the Holy Land from the non-Jews, we should know also us how to do bargaining. Mekachumemkar. And because we're going to have to pay, you know, Kesef Male, full payment for every piece of land. Now, it's hard to see that a young 6 or 7 year old Mulliver would say that, but that's exactly what he was involved in, that we have to start buying the land, things like that. So it's reading into his past. But okay, very nice. And if you look in Rav Maimon, you have the typical Iluim stories about him when he was young. And he does marry at age 15. That's not a legend. He does. And he's supported by his father-in-law for a few years. That was the common theme in those days. You'd be supported the guest. You'd be supported by the father-in-law. I don't know. I'm really not up on whether in the Haredi world today in America, in Israel, you have the government supporting you. I don't know in America if the fathers-in-law still, I mean, because I know some people learn and it's not the father-in-law, it's the father who supports the son's learning. But I don't know if today in the Haredi world there's this inyan, this concept that it's the father-in-law who should support you. I guess the father-in-law is wealthy and you're, but someone could maybe type in about that. But after being supported by his father-in-law for a few years, he goes to learn in Volozhin.
It's
And we're
called.
told that while he's there, he supports himself by working. It's said that he refused to take money from the yeshiva. He stays there. Of course, a great Talmud Chacham. Everyone in Volozhin was a Talmud Chacham. I mean, yeshiva in those days was for the elites. The only people who went to Volozhin were the elites of the elites. He was given smicha by Rav Yitzchak Volozhiner. That's the son of Rav Chaim, Rosh Yeshiva. And then he serves as a rabbi for 6 years in his hometown. They knew him, I guess. They hired him. In 1854, he becomes Rav in Lita at a place called Shaki. And in 1860, 6 years in Shaki, he becomes Rav in Suvok, an important town in Lita. Those who went to YU, Yeshiva Yochanan, might recall that Rav David Lifshitz was known as the Suvalker Rav. He was the last Rav of Suvok, because there was no community after the war. And there was a big rabbanim served as Rav in Suvok. In 1868, he becomes Rav in Radom. That's in Poland, actually. So this is a bit of a problem because he have a Lithuanian Talmud Chacham. Now he's in a community where most of the people are Hasidim. So that's always going to be interesting. In fact, Maimon reports another story. I can't vouch for its accuracy, but it says that the Hasidim loved him. So much so they started treating him like Hasidus Rebbe. They even wanted to take Shirayim. For those who don't know, and I've seen this one time, I saw the Shirayim because I was at a tish. And when I say I saw the Shirayim, I saw the people grabbing for Shirayim. There's always Shirayim given out, but I saw some guy jump on a table and grab it. For those who don't know, the Hasidim, not all Hasidim, but many of the Hasidim have this concept of Shirayim. That is, when the Rebbe tastes the food, you know, from, let's say you have a challah or a fish and he takes a little bit of it and puts it down, then the fish is holy. His holiness has gone into the fish and you want to grab it. Now, it gets a little disgusting for us non-Hasidim because the Rebbes only eat with their hands. That's the tradition. So they'll eat the fish or the chicken. They won't use forks. Maybe there's some modern Hasidim who do, but in the traditional Hasidic world, they don't use silverware. And, they take a bite or two, and then it's they could give it to their the Hasidic leaders, Hasidic followers, who they're, I guess, the favored Hasidic followers. But I, with my own eyes, saw it was the Bava Tish, as I recall, where someone just jumps up and grabs it after the Rebbe put it down. But again, well, I'll hear from the different Hasidim who listen how it works in their courts. But sometimes they throw it or they pass. I've seen it with the tray. They pass it out. They send it down. And I've been to a few different tishes of Rebbe. So if you ever go to Borough Park, which I used to do as a kid, you can go there. So I go to the various tishes and you can see the Shirayim. So they wanted to take Shirayim from him. And of course, as a Litvish Gadol, he would have nothing of this. Now, Maimon has the following story to show how finally Rav Mulliver was able to stop the Hasidim from treating him as a Rebbe, Rebbe worship, I guess you could say. So one day he had Shol HaShuddos at his home, and all the Hasidim come, And what does he do? He invites his wife to sit next to him at the head of the table while he reads Shalosh Shodes. And Maimon tells us that was enough for the Hasidim. They no longer held of him, and some even turned into his enemies, because to have the Rebbetzin sit there while you're speaking Torah, that was something they couldn't handle. Now, what's interesting is that Rav Moliver did not need the Rabbonus for his Parnassah. He had property that was used for agriculture. I don't know if he inherited it or came with his wife. I have to look into that. And so he actually had property that was, they made money on the agriculture, and perhaps it's speculated, Yosef Salmon, a scholar in Israel, he has this book, Im Ta'iru, which the subtitle is Orthodoxy, and I guess you would say in the throes of nationalism. And so I guess I would translate the title, well, in the grip of nationalism, there's an English title page. So he has chapters on basically religious Zionism, the conflicts between the Orthodox and the supporters of Zionism and the opponents of Zionism. He has a whole chapter here on the controversy over Etrogim from Corfu and Etrogim Eretz Yisrael, because that was a big issue there. It had to do with Tzion, because they used to get the Etrogim from Greece. And also from Italy, but Corfu and Etrogim were big ones. And once they started, planting Etrogim in Eretz Yisrael, so a lot of Rabbanim put a cheirim on the Etrogim of Corfu. Now, that raises all sorts of interesting questions, because, if the Etrog of Corfu is kosher, can the rabbis really just declare it, put a cheirim on it and say you can't buy it because we want to support the settlers? Well, they did, but and not all the rabbis went along with it. Some rabbis said this is our minhag to use Corfu, and Chabad get it from Calabria in Italy. The whole issue of the Corfu Esrogim were important because they were pushed out because the rabbis wanted us to buy Eretz Yisrael. In fact, today, other than Chabadnikim, who still get that Calabria Esrog, I haven't seen any Esrogim from anywhere else. There used to be a guy in Dallas, Texas, where he had Esrogim. It was called Zadie's Esrog Farm. I once bought an Esrog from him because my attitude was, just because it's not an Eretz Yisrael, I shouldn't give him business. He needs business also. But I haven't seen any Esrogim anywhere other than Israel, except for Moroccan Esrogim. Although I don't see them in my communities, but the Satmar and others, you still can get them Moroccan Esrogim. So he has an article in here on Rav Moliver, and he discusses a number of the themes we're going to see, including the fact that he had agriculture. Now, during Rav Moliver, he's born in 1824. In his early years in the rabbinate, you already see the beginnings of the ideological conflicts between the rabbis and the maskilim. Maskilim who are religious maskilim, and non-religious maskilim. Now we're going to see there, Rav Moliver, really, you'll be able to call him one of the religious maskilim. I shouldn't say he's not a maskil, but an advocate of religious haskalah, because to be a maskil, you need to know all these different areas. He doesn't know that, but he actually believes that people should know that. And Rav Moliver joins the disputes. He's not like some of the other rabbis, as we'll see, who were, their attitude was just to say everything is great in traditional society. He understood, as we'll see right now, the problems in traditional society. In fact, there was a Hebrew periodical. It was published in various places, including in Paris. It was called Halavanon. It's like the first of the long-lasting Hebrew newspapers. So the first part of it is, if you want to know what's going on in the Jewish world, especially the Orthodox world, you have to read the first part of it. Every week it came out. You can see it now. The Jewish National Library in Jerusalem has the website where they've put online lots and lots of these Hebrew newspapers, loads of them. They put online many other things as well. When I was at Harvard, they had a whole project to put all these things on microfiche, and they spent a fortune. And it wasn't even 10 years, I think, after they finished that project, the new digital technology. So all these microfiches, they're obsolete, and everything is on the website there. So, and it's amazing because in the old days, if I wanted to see the article, I'm going to show you articles now, or from Hall of Unknown, I would have had to go to let's say, the seminary or a New York Public Library, WALU doesn't have it, and order the old issue. It takes an entire day, and maybe they won't even have the issue you need. So now you got everything. And Ramoliver publishes, as a fairly young rabbi, is publishing articles in Hal of Unknown. By the way, the second part of each issue, you have Hal of Unknown, and in the second part of each issue, you have something called Kavod Hal of Unknown, which is scholarship. And the Gedolei Yisrael are writing not really about Gemara or Halacha, but about interesting issues, biblical interpretation, unusual things, not typical articles mostly. So he has an article. And this is all the people who wrote about Rav Moliver know this. They refer to these articles. He has an article in which he says, for instance, that with the help of the government, we should establish a school that includes secular studies. So whereas many of the other rabbis were fighting against this, Rav Moliver is saying, and not only is he saying it, he went to a meeting in St. Petersburg of the Maskilim, and he said that Emuna and Haskalah are both what he called Benot Elokim. That they're both valuable, and so there's nothing wrong with Haskalah. What's wrong with Haskalah is going to be irreligious Haskalah, but that Jews should be learned and wise in well, I'll read you what he says right now. Now we are very fortunate, although that hold on a second, although that I can show you, for instance, here, let me show you, let me share my screen. So it's easy. Here you see, it's very easy. You can pull up Hall of Unknown, and then you can enlarge it. You can, there's a PDF on the side. You can click on it, and it turns it into the. It'll pull up the issue you want, and I'll show you how this works. And it takes in 1 minute. You can see something that would take a whole day. So you can pull it up. Well, notice what it says. It's Michtav Iti b'Shfat Eiver, Hebrew. It's a weekly. At this time, it's being published in Mainz, etc. But we're also fortunate that this year, Magid Press came out with something interesting. In fact, Rabbi Reuven Ziegler, who works in Magid, when he saw the Torah in Motion announcement, he said that he sent me an email that, I'm speaking on Rav Moliver. Do I know about the new book that came out? And I actually saw an ad for it about 6 months ago, or even less. Here's the book. It's called Brit. It's Rav Moliver, Brit Ahava V'Hashalom. What it is, it's Ketavim Atzionut Chinuch Machshava Maaseh. Basically, it's all the writings of Rav Moliver that they know about. They gathered in one volume here, dealing with Zionism, education, Hashkafa. And actions. It has footnotes, and it is a big introduction here, which deals with mostly his involvement with Chovei Tzion. So all the important articles that I'm interested in, at least, are reprinted in this volume. So let me tell you what he says when he went to the leaders of Haskalah, Russian Haskalah, in St. Petersburg, and he says to them that. He says, we are in an amazing time here because we have the ability. The first time he says, I've seen it, the ability, he says something which I've hoped for years, l'ached et dorshei hachachma im tofsei haTorah, to unify dorshei hachachma, the people who, the maskilim, the ones who are looking into chachma. Chachma refers to everything other than traditional Torah learning. It refers to secular, here it refers to secular study. Sometimes it refers to things like Jewish philosophy, but he says, when he says Chochmah and Torah, I think here he means secular wisdom. And he says, this will enable us to improve the situation of the Jewish people. Remember how the Jews lived in Tsarist Russia. I mean, there was enormous poverty, no chance of economic advancement. And these Jews would look at how Jews lived in Germany. Where they lived, in a much, even though they were not involved in what we would call academic careers, you did have some doctors, and but they lived a much more enlightened life And well, the government was much more enlightened then. So he's talking about how the answer, how we can improve ourselves is education. And what he gives examples here. So when you think about this, is Ramolliver, who's going to be one of the Gadol Yisrael, he's someone who really is following the German Orthodox path. He says that we should make Talmud Torahs and yeshivos, obviously, have to be under the authority of the rabbis. However, they should also be recognized by the government. How do you recognize by the government? You have to learn Russian, the Yediot HaNechutzot, and necessary knowledge. In other words, the idea that you're living in Russia and you don't speak the language, we will see for Ramolliver, that is a Chilul Hashem. That is not the Jewish way, but that's how Jews live. They didn't speak the language. So there's no way you can advance yourself. You can't advance yourself economically. You can't be part of society. You're living basically a ghetto lifestyle, and which is not, and especially in an era when you could see that things are going to be changing. If the Jews are going to remain ignorant of the vernacular, it's a problem. He says that Smicha, he wants to unify. This article originally appears in Halavanon, that we can't have a situation, he says, where any rabbi is giving smicha. No, we need to have an organized system, I guess, in Russia, where you have smicha from rabbanim, gedolim, and the mashgichim of the yeshivas, and that there be tests. There was a problem. You never people would show up, and they'd pull out a document that some rabbi gave them smicha. Who knows what type of smicha this is? So, I mean, we have the same issue today, I guess. Then he says, we need third proposal. We have to create vocational schools, schools where they teach them melacha for those young men who have the talent and desire to do this. And in these schools, these schools will be under the authority, the hashgacha of the rabbis, and you'll teach them Russian. So, in other words, the schools where you could teach them a vocation and teach them some Torah, and it's recognized by the government. This appears so obvious to us, but you didn't have anything like this in Russia. Nothing. Zilch. All you had was the cheder and the yeshivas. The idea that you'd have a school recognized by the government where you teach people a career, a parnasa, that's not at all. Number four, he says that we should work with the government that these schools are recognized with the same rights and privileges as the non-Jewish schools, and that the rabbis should be recognized at the same level as he calls them Sha'ar Kohanei Dat, all the non-Jewish religious leaders, that we have the same status. I don't see how that would be possible. Russian Orthodoxy was the religion. Everything else is only tolerated. So he's dreaming a bit, I guess. But and his fifth thing is, and this today you get put in cheirim for saying this, but he wasn't put in cheirim. He remains among the rabbanim in Russia, one of the recognized rabbanim. We're going to see how Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, what he thought about him. But what does he say? He says that we have to hafitz haskalah gam bein ha charedim v'ha'areim. The word charedi in 19th century doesn't mean charedi like we have today. It means they're religious Jews. He says that we want to spread haskalah, which means just knowledge of the world, enlightenment, education. So you can pick up a Russian newspaper and understand. Remember that scene in Fiddler on the Roof? One guy, could read the Russian newspaper and tell him what's going on. But we're going to be part of society here. And he says that the religious, the Orthodox, are the majority in our land, and it was at that time. And he says the problem is the younger generation is being removed from Torah. Well, that's a problem. If you don't educate the young Orthodox Jews, they're going to want to be part of the broader world. They're going to leave Torah Judaism. So we have to educate the young people with secular knowledge as well. He says that the non-religious see that the general schools are open to them, and therefore we have to allow the we have to offer something to the Orthodox as well. So that's already, we see that Reb Molliver, he's one of the younger rabbis. These things always have to come from the young rabbis. It's very rare to have the old rabbis willing to step out and come up with new ideas. I think today in Israel, The older Rosh Yeshiva, I think it's hopeless to think that there's going to be any changes. What you'll have probably is a younger, second level Rosh Yeshiva who are going to start, maybe some army, getting jobs, that sort of thing. They're the ones who can do it. The older ones are too set in their ways. I mean, the problem is when the younger ones do it, then it becomes a big machlokes and they attack them. But if the older ones would do it, maybe you would have some acceptance. But the older ones, historically, we've seen that all these sort of things, all the changes, it only comes from the younger rabbis. They're the ones who are able to make those steps. So we see Reb Oliver arguing in a provocative fashion for something that hadn't been done yet. In fact, Salmon, in his article, page 134, cites another provocative statement from Oliver, also in an article in Halavanon, where he says that Reb Oliver even suggests that when he talks about productive labor, what is productive labor? Like the fields. And things of that nature, not just being merchants. He says, Avosenu harishonim hayu ovdei adamah v'roei tzon. Our forefathers, the people came before us, they worked the land. The sages of the Talmud, they were craftsmen of various sorts. Why can't we do this? This was always a problem. The non-Jews kicked us out. They didn't let us, but the then Jews, even when they had the opportunities, they didn't want to involve themselves with this because they adopted a certain type of lifestyle and the idea that they would work the land or things. I mean, it's just that was not really their lifestyle. Now, he said he had agriculture, but he's not working the land. He's hiring people, no doubt non-Jews, to work the land for him. So this was a revolution when Jews went back to working the land. And but his point is that traditional society doesn't do that. He goes further. He says that the traditional society, they don't learn what he calls Hilchos Derech Eretz. Hilchos Derech Eretz doesn't mean how to be a polite person. It means what you need to know to live in the world today. He says that they could learn this from the other nations because the other nations, they know how to live properly in the world. So we see already Reb Oliver ahead of his time, you could say. There is a master's dissertation by a woman named Nurit Merari. Her master's dissertation is called Land of Israel in the Thought of Shmuel Oliver. And she also quotes some interesting things. She went through all the articles in Halavanon. So let me quote you some of the interesting things. Why this is so, I find this significant, because even before Reb Oliver gets involved in Chovei Tzion, you see that he's thinking out of the box. In fact, if you want to know what gave him the ability or the inclination to think out of the box when it came to Chovei Tzion, because the idea that you're going to leave Russia and go to Eretz Yisrael and set up settlements there, that's like out of the box thinking. You see that he was already thinking out of the box about the situation of the Jews in Russia. He saw the problem, and really, the solution for Eretz Yisrael, it's not a messianic solution. It's not Rav Kook. It's very practical. It's a way to save the Jews in a physical sense, not in the way in any messianic type of thing. So basically, the turn to Eretz Yisrael is an outgrowth of what we see here. So what else does Rav Oliver say that Merari calls attention to? Okay, the language. This is something he returns to often, that Jews need to speak the language. Like I said, it's hard to imagine living in a society where people do not speak the language. When I say don't speak the language, I don't mean don't speak the language like maybe you meet people from Kiryas Yoel. Although all the people I know from Kiryas Yoel speak English perfectly, and even if they have an accent. Years ago, I met people who you wondered about it, but now they all speak it, either because of the internet or something. But in Russia, you literally had people who didn't speak Russian. Now, maybe they could buy a loaf of bread, but they could not read it. They could not carry on a conversation with any value of any sophistication. I was told by the son of Reshlomo David Kahane. Reshlomo David Kahane was one of the big rabbanim in Warsaw. He escapes the Holocaust because his son, Yitzhak Kahane, I think his name is Yitzhak, he was a minister in one of the government in Israel, in various governments of Israel, a leading Mizrahi figure. His father becomes Rav of the old city. And he dies, I think, 51. But I heard from his son, Yitzhak Kahane. Yitzhak Kahane, by the way, who was, he might have been minister of religion once. You have to check it. Very involved in a lot, or he was Mankal. You can look him up on Wikipedia. He told me, incidentally, that Rav Huttner very much wanted to be chief rabbi of the state of Israel, which is not recorded in any of the biographies. But he told me that when he was in Poland, there were Jews who used to hang out outside the courthouse or government buildings, and they'd make their living because Jews would have to come there and things in the government buildings, but they didn't speak Polish. So these Jews who knew Polish, they would be hired to be the intermediary. So Ramolover insists that Jews need to know the language of the land they're living in. Not just bal peh, but also writing. And this isn't just a matter of Chil Hashem or anything like that, but this is going to lead to a better life for the Jews and a better relationship with their non-Jewish neighbors. Remember, Jews lived among non-Jews. And you need to be able to speak the language properly. And furthermore, what does he say? He says that... what else can I tell you? He says, he says that many of the rabbis, the Jews, their attitude is that, you know, we sit here in Russia and we wait for the Messiah. And that's it. And Ramolover says that that's not the approach. He says that we need to find ways to improve our situation. And one of them is not only is the languages, but other yidiot, other knowledge, which is necessary lefi hazman v'hamakom, which is necessary for the era that the time we're living in. What else does Ramolover say in some of these articles? He deals with the relationship of Jews and non-Jews. I don't need to tell you that the relationship of Jews and non-Jews in Russia was not always so good. That doesn't mean it was always so bad. I mean, yes, there are pogroms, but... by the way, those who haven't seen the news, Amsterdam, it's happening again today. Things were going on today as well. Yes, there were pogroms, and you had a lot of anti-Semitism, but you also had Jews and non-Jews who got along. That's always been the situation. And where Ramolover says is that the non-Jews have negative feelings about the Jews, because they feel the Jews live apart from them and are not, they're not part of society. Obviously, the fact that they don't speak the language is one thing, but more, the non-Jews said that they tried to get out of the draft. You know, there's a draft, and they try to get out of it, which is true, I have to say, and. You know, after the Cantonist, so there was still, I mean, you still could be drafted, and Jews would get out of it. Jews would pay money too, because you couldn't remain a religious Jew in the army. He says that non-Jews also see that Jews oppose, they don't listen to the rules of the government. I'm sure there were non-Jews who didn't listen to the rules of the government, but also Jews didn't listen to the rules of the government. So what does Ramolover say? That... his point is that, yes, there are individual Jews who do this, but the non-Jews use this and turn it into an attack on Jews as a whole. Now, I have to say that when it comes to breaking the law, that would have been true. You know, the non-Jews, that's what Chil Hashem is, that you break the law, and then it's a Chil Hashem because everyone takes it out on Jews as a whole. But I think in these articles in Hall of Unknown, you have to assume, at least in some areas, that there's a an eye to the non-Jewish, maybe the censors, because although these were not published in Russia, they were then shipped into Russia, so the censor would read them. And if they didn't like things in them, they would cut it out. Because, I mean, for Ramolover to imply that not all Jews are trying to get out of the draft, that this is only some of them. And you should look, let's be realistic here. Everyone was trying to get out of the draft, and that's it's no secret. And he calls it like a false accusation, but it certainly was not a false accusation. And he says, we need to. So that I think when you read stuff in some of his writings, you need to see what's you take for real and what's just for an outside person. Now, although let me just add something here. The Jews lived sort of as a separate lifestyle. They were not involved in the government. They lived as a in their own ghetto. And like their own, they had their own autonomy, and they were like a separate nationality in the Russian Empire, and they regarded themselves as a separate nationality. No Jew living in Russia regarded themselves as Russian, just like no Jew living in Poland regarded themselves as Poland. They were Jews or Lithuania. No Jews in Hungary thought of themselves as Hungarian, definitely. Jews, including the Orthodox, Jews in Germany thought of themselves as German, but no one thought that way in Russia. And they were not involved in the government at all. So they were like, so yes, people could have a negative feeling about them that they're not involved, but everyone understood they're separate. That is different, by the way. I just want to mention it because I mentioned the situation in Israel before. I heard an interview with Rav Stav on Scott Kahn's podcast. And Scott Kahn, it's called Orthodox Conundrum. I know Scott because when I was had my job at Brandeis University as the rabbi there, if those who remember from a couple of years ago, the classes on my latest book, Scott Kahn was a student then, and then he went on, got smicha, he opened up a yeshiva in Israel for a while. In any event, so he's interviewing Rabbi Stav, and Rabbi Stav says, the real problem with the Haredim in Israel today, as he sees it, I mean, he says there's a number of problems, but one of the, but here you have the Haredim are in the government, and they're voting for war. So how is it that they are voting for war when they don't send their kids to war? It's one, you know, if they were living like Satmar, not involved, that's one thing. But they are part of the government and they're taking responsibility. So how, there's a moral problem here. How do you take responsibility for going to war when your children don't have to pay the price? So, in fact, I heard the following from someone. I don't need to mention his name, but anyone who's in Boston and goes to the Boston Rebbe, you know who I'm talking about, because there's only Boston Rebbe. There's only a few people there who'd be called Chassidim. And there was only one guy when I was there who wore a strimal. So anyone from Boston know who I'm referring to. And he told me the following story. He doesn't come from a Hasidic background, but he told me that in the 60s, he went, or early 70s, he went to the Agudas, it must have been in the early 70s, he went to the Agudas Yisrael convention one year. He went to the Aguda convention. He told me two interesting things about the Aguda convention he went to. He said that one of the things that was said there, this is from a later convention, and I won't say which Rosh Yeshiva, because I maybe it'll be Lashon Hara, but it's a good story. He says that they had like an Ask the Rosh Yeshiva night or something, and a couple of the Rosh Yeshiva. And one of the people in the audience stands up and introduces himself. And Rebbe, you remember me? Yes, of course, the Rosh Yeshiva. I remember you. Says, you know, when we were in yeshiva, you told us, you know, that we should go into chinuch and teach Torah, and we'll live a life of dachkus, of difficulty. But, you know, this, we're doing God's word and all that. And, you know, the Rosh Yeshiva is, yes, yes, yes. And then the man says, well, then Rebbe, how come you're now telling your Talmidim not to marry my daughters? You know, because they're basically, the Rosh Yeshiva was telling them to marry a rich guy so he could support you in learning. So he told me that the room was silent. No one said a word. Because here you have someone, a student, you know, who followed what the Rosh Yeshiva said to go into a career where you weren't making the big bucks. And now he's challenging him. Why then are you telling people not to marry my daughters? Only go for the rich people. And, okay. So that's, but that's not the story reason I mention it, because he said they had, this would have been the early 70s. They wanted to send, in the name of Agudas Yisrael, a message to the president. So it would have been Nixon, of unanimous support for your carrying out the war in Vietnam. One of these, you know, messages. So they had a, you know, they had a gathering there, and they were going to take a Aguda. I don't know if they still do, but in those days, they still, like, they follow all these form, you know, the old ways of doing things, like you take a motion and you take a vote and all that. So they had everyone in the room, and they said that they wanted to get approval to send a message of support for the president for, the war in Vietnam against, I guess, the godless communists. So everyone raises their hand, the ayes and then the nays. And he said, this is what he told me. He's the only person, he raises his hand. No. And I said, well, what? You don't support it? He says, it's not a question of whether I support it or not. He said, but none of your sons are in the army. None of them are fighting. So how is it that you should have a say and want to, tell Nixon to continue the war when you're not paying the price for it? And he told me with a lot of pride that as a result of that, the message that they sent to Nixon couldn't say that a Aguda gathering unanimously sends its whatever support. It had to say with strong support or overwhelming support or something like that. He said because he was the only person that refused to go along with this. And look, he has a point. This is an issue that comes up in these towns that become majority Orthodox because the people, then they control the school boards. And yet their own kids, though, don't go to the public school. So the question is there a conflict of interest there? Because you can cut the budgets because your kids are not in the school. So let's leave that aside. So what does Rav Moaver say? He says that we need to educate Russian Jews to have love and of our king under who we live. And this is, he says, al pi chukei haTorah, because the king is trying to make the country a good king, and we have to follow their laws and be loyal citizens and love the nation. Okay, that's what they say. He goes on and says that we cannot engage in illegal behavior. If he says that he says you'll find in the Talmud many passages that tell us that we have to love le'ahov es kol adam, to love every man u'lidrosh tovaso, and to look out for his well-being, u'hashiv avedaso, and to return his lost objects, and to not deceive him without any distinction li'hevdel dat ve'emunah. Now, it's true that you have people that say that, but you have people who say otherwise, because the simple ex-Talmudic passage, explanation of the Talmud doesn't say this at all. It doesn't say that you need to return the lost objects, and it doesn't say you have to love everyone. You love Jews. However, there is a whole you love Jews. That's the mitzvah, not non-Jews. But there's a tradition. There's also writers in the tradition, Sfarim, that expand this. In terms of returning lost objects, things like that, they say it doesn't apply when the Talmud speaks about there's no need to return these lost objects unless you make a Kiddush Hashem. It only applies to the wicked pagans of old. It doesn't apply to the civilized people we live in, and not when the law is that you have to return lost objects, that sort of thing. And second of all, loving all people, you have to have passages that say this. Rav Kook says a numerous, but forget Rav Kook, Rav Chaim Vital says that you have to love everyone. So what does that mean? Love everyone? I mean, the halacha seems to be. I mean, how can you love everyone? V'ahavta le'acha kamocha, your re'acha. It's hard enough to love that. You're going to say you love everyone? It's not realistic. In fact, I like to explain the non-Jews like to criticize us because their understanding is the golden rule: do unto others what you want to yourself. And we have it in a negative way that don't do to others what you don't want done to yourself. But the truth is that the golden rule is completely unrealistic. You're never going to love anyone like yourself. It's unnatural. It's impossible. You're always going to have your own interests more than other people. So when Chazal explains to them, what does it mean, love your neighbor as yourself? In a practical way, what is that? Don't do to others what you don't want done to yourself. But you can't realistically, do it in a positive way, because that's not reality. You have a maybe a tzaddik once in a generation who can actually love others like he loves himself in a positive sense. But we can't get rid of our self-interest. So Chazal tell us what it means is we can certainly not do the bad thing that we don't want him done to ourself. But you do have these passages, and Rav Oliver says that he's saying this is apologetic or not. You'd have to figure out what it is or not. He seems to be trying to create an environment where, again, love can mean different things. Obviously, you love, just like you love your family, even if when we say you love all Jews, you're always going to love your family more than people you don't know. I mean, that's just natural. So clearly, yes, you love Jews with a deeper love, but that doesn't mean you can't have ahava. What does ahava mean? Ahava could mean love, it could mean good relations, feeling, you know, you can translate all different ways. So I don't see this as only apologetic. He goes on and says that even more than that, he says there's a lot to learn from the non-Jews. He says we can learn and see the term Hilchos Derech Eretz from the non-Jews. And he says, quote, V'yadua, ki raboseinu balei ha-Talmud. He says, the rabbis of the Talmud, lamdu harbe pamim, they learned a number of times, eze hilchos derech eretz mishar lomei tevo. They would learn from the non-Jews proper things, proper ways to live, good ways, good things to do. I mentioned this in the past, that when I was in Israel, in Yeshiva, Rabbi Berzon, who was one of the rabbis there, said that you know, there's a lot we could learn in Israel from America. He mentioned the idea of a line. That you go to the bank, you wait on line. I think in Israel today you do, but in those days, everyone just come in from all sides and put yourself in. You know, there's things you can learn from the non-Jews. There's plenty of passages in Sfarim and other Gemara and others that speak about this. So Rav Moliver is saying that he's trying to get rid of this idea that it's an us versus them. And he says that even in Russia, we could be part of the society. He sees in Germany how people are part of the society. If you went to Germany in the mid-19th century, it's not an us versus them. It's not the non-Jews versus the Jews living in a ghetto. Jews are part of the society, even though they're Torah observant. And he's looking forward to a time where in Russia, but Jews can be part of the society. The problem is that obviously there's discrimination against the Jews, but it's more than that because the Jews themselves are not, they have to go halfway. They have to start speaking the language. And they have to start getting involved in wider pursuits. And maybe if they do that, then the Russian government will take a half step in their direction. That's what he's looking forward to. In fact, I pulled up one of his articles, just an article I saw referenced, but I wanted to see the whole article from Hallel Hanon, and I found something really interesting in it. This is from February 25th, 1874, in which he speaks about how we do not believe in religious coercion. He says that, he says, Ein zechus, or I'll say it in Sephardic, Ein zechut of koach ba'olam, there's no one has the right or the strength to force anyone from any religion to give up their religion and adopt your own religion. And he says, this is obviously not going to be practical. It's create disputes. But he says, no one has the right to do that. And then he says something interesting in the footnote. Fascinating. He points to this Gemara. Look, you can see this as an apologetic thing. I was saying that, you know, no one has the right to tell anyone else what other religion to adopt. But knowing that in the Messianic era, maybe the Jews can force everyone to give up their idolatry, all that sort of thing. But he cites a Gemara, this Gemara, in the footnote, not in the article itself. Hold on, let me, let's see. It's in Avodah Zarah, Daf Beis. I thought I pulled. Here it is. What does the Gemara say? The Gemara says as follows. Where is it? Here. Okay. Instead of what Beis on the Beis. The Gemara asks, where do we know that the non-Jews did not fulfill the Shev Mitzvah Spinning Noach? And they cite a pasuk. Rav Yosef teaches, he stands and shakes, in explanation of the verse in Chavakuk, he stands and shakes the earth, he sees and makes a nation tremble, Vayater. So then they say, what did God see? He saw the seven mitzvot that the sons of Noah accepted on themselves, and he saw they didn't fulfill them. Since they didn't fulfill them, he arose and nullified, reading it with Vehitiran, the command to heed these mitzvot. Okay. And then the Gemara goes on and says, you know, do the non-Jews gain anything from the mitzvos now that there's no obligation? Then they say that the Gemara explains that they receive a reward, but they don't receive a reward as if they're obligated in it. Okay, but what I want to ask you, what does this mean when it says the Gemara says Amad v'hitiran lahen? I'm reading you the English translation here. God nullified for them the command to heed the Shev Mitzvahs B'nei Noach. So first of all, this is an amazing passage, which, if you look in all the sources, or most of the sources, this is just ignored that those words, and the assumption is we don't accept it. You look in the Rambam, Mishneh Torah, it'll have the Seven Mitzvahs B'nei Noach. Everyone knows, you're taught in school, right? Non-Jews are obligated in Seven Mitzvahs B'nei Noach. No, but what about this Gemara that says they're no longer obligated in it? And then it asks the whole question, and if they're not obligated, that means they don't get any reward for doing anything. Oh, people don't talk about it. Don't. I wonder, by the way, I think maybe it's not referring to natural law, like killing or stealing. Maybe it's only referring to idolatry, other things. But be that as it may, before I get to Reb Oliver, this is a very interesting text. And there are passages in my review of Jonathan Sacks's book a number of years ago. I call attention to the fact that you have sources, including the Abarbanel, and as I recall, the Achaeus Yitzhak, who state that non-Jews are not obligated to Shem Mitzvahs B'nei Noach. They take this Gemara, and that explains that for them, non-Jews can worship idolatry. This is not in line with the Halacha, as recorded by the Rambam, and not in line with the overwhelming majority approach. But that's how they understand. There's a pasuk. The pasuk says that they look to the sky, and God gave them these stars, which people interpreted that non-Jews are allowed to. So you have this view, and I quote some other sources that assume that non-Jews are not obligated, let's say, in Avodah Zarah anymore. So that I mean, non-Jews can kill or steal. They don't say that. So I think the assumption is that those would be forbidden, not because of Shem Mitzvahs B'nei Noach, but I think for natural law sort of reasons, perhaps. I'm not sure, because it makes no sense to say that for Abarbanel to say that non-Jews can kill and get away with it. That doesn't make sense. And he specifically refers to Avodah Zarah. But what does Reb Oliver, though, picks up on this? And he says that after saying that no one can force someone else to abandon their religion, he says, perhaps this is what Rav Yosef is getting at here when Rav Yosef says that Kadosh Baruch Hu hitir lahem the Shem Mitzvahs B'nei Noach. He says, Ratzono sh'azvam abachirat. He left the non-Jews to their own free will, and didn't allow any nation to force them to observe the Seven Mitzvahs B'nei Noach. So Reb Oliver is saying maybe that's the point, that we're now in an era where no one can force anyone else, and that's okay, that the non-Jews are not obligated in it. I mean, but it's still wild. He's a posek, he's a halachist to say this. So it's a fascinating idea that the non-Jews, like I said, I think you need to see them as having some sort of basic obligation in human relations, because otherwise you'd have hefkeros, you'd have chaos in the world. But something like maybe setting up courts and Iver Min HaChai and idolatry, I remember there's a number of sources that seem to say that the non-Jews are given the stars, that they can worship it. How can the non-Jews worship the stars? That's idolatry. So, but then this is not the mainstream view, but this is, you have this view out there. And so we're going to see next class, we're going to move in, and there's a few other interesting articles Reb Oliver has, but he really comes into his own with Eretz Yisrael. During this time period, when he's writing all these articles and publishing them, about the need to learn the language and make Jews more productive, all the things we've been speaking about today, there's not a word about Eretz Yisrael. And if all you had were his published writings, you would conclude, as I'm sure many did, that only later, 2 decades later, does he then, or a decade and a half, I should say, later, no, not even less than that, a decade later, does he then come to see Eretz Yisrael as the solution to the problems? And we're going to see how he sees it and why he sees it. However, his grandson In the 20th century, years after his death, his grandson published a lot of his writings, writings that he himself never published. And at the very time that Rav Mulliver was publishing the sort of articles that I just discussed with you, he was also writing about Eretz Yisrael. Why he didn't publish it, maybe he thought it would sound too crazy to people, or maybe it didn't make any sense. But we'll see after the pogrom, 1881, and the situation is even more dire economically. Then Rav Mulliver, we're going to see, start speaking about Eretz Yisrael. And, I mean, he accomplishes a great deal, as we'll see. He didn't accomplish so much in these other ideas he had, but he accomplished a great deal with Eretz Yisrael. But it's not something that came out of the blue. He was thinking about these things for a long time. So that's what we will we'll pick up next class. Let's see. Okay, so we hear about the kibbutz land. Yeah, well, we'll talk about that later. Nissen, there are unkosher at Drogim. The man known as Saba Kadisha considered lemons to be kosher at Drogim, but that's a minority opinion. Yes, the Saba Kadisha thing, I wrote about this in the Lehrhaus, my Lehrhaus article on the Esrogim. The Saba Kadisha did consider them, and the fact is that I'm sure in Europe lots of people used lemons as Esrogim. I mean, it's not like today where everyone has an Esrog. You'd wait months to get an Esrog shipped to you, and I'm sure there's lots of lemons going around. The Saba Kadisha, that's Rav Shlomo Ezra Alfandari, he thought that Esrogim are part of the Esrog family, and they're perfectly valid as Esrogim, but they were not, his opinion was not accepted. So much so that we have a whole inyan called Esrogim Morkavim. That's an important thing, not to have grafted Esrogim. Now, this is not mentioned in the Rishonim or the Gemara, this idea. Who says that an Etrog can't be grafted? You won't find any Rishonim who say that. In fact, we know that when people started returning to Eretz Yisrael, all the Esrogim were grafted. Everyone was using a grafted Esrog. That was the only Esrogim they have. Today, we're told that none of the Esrogim are grafted and things are good. That was always the issue in Corfu. Were the Esrogim grafted or not? But this is something, this is not part, this comes in a few hundred years ago, but this is not something the Rishonim were concerned about grafted. But obviously, if lemons are a problem, if they're not Esrogim, then you can see why grafted, they would graft the lemon, because the lemon tree is stronger than an Esrog tree, that would be, that would create a an issue, not for the Saba Kadisha. The Saba Kadisha is the one, if you know the story, maybe we'll do classes on the Munkacher, Rav Chaim Ozer Shapira. Chaim Ozer Shapira goes to Eretz Yisrael to meet the Saba Kadisha. He sees him as this messianic figure. We don't know how old Rav Afandri was when he died. I mean, some people talk about him as being like 110, 120. He probably was closer to 100 years old. There's even a Babmeister that he made his way to Pressburg and met the Chazon and met the Chasam Sofer when he was, I mean, crazy stuff about him. iPad from Toronto.
Do you know what the origin of the name Moholiyav is? Is it Mohel?
I guess so. I don't know. Could be. I don't know. Let's see. Moshe says perhaps he was influenced by Israel Itzel on this matter. Yeah, Max Lilienthal reported that Itzel had something to his skull too. Excellent point, Moshe. Moshe Schwartz. So that. I've been mentioning Moshe from Lakewood, so there's two Moshe from Lakewoods, but that's one of the Moshe from Lakewoods, so you know. Yes, if you, Max, Reb Itzela was willing to go along with certain modernization efforts, let's put it that way, by the Russian government, because they saw these as necessary, as valuable. So, yes, the Rishash was another one. We had these figures, so you know, I think for many of the younger Rabbonim in particular, I wrote about this with Chiyak of Weinberg, he's obviously two generations later, the younger Rabbonim always see things that the older Rabbonim don't. But so whether he's influenced by him or whether he saw it on his own, I don't know. iPad says, taxes and money are also a price not paid. Receiving money for yeshivas during wartime is also a moral issue, especially during a time of labor shortage. Obviously, we could have a lot of discussion of the situation in Israel, but... The Haredim do pay taxes, but yes, they get money for their yeshivas. So, but okay, that's a different issue though. Moshe says the maskana of the Gemara there in Avodah Zarah is that they just don't get reward like a regular mitzvah. Not that they aren't responsible for Shem mitzvahs anymore. Yes, and I know that. But the thing is, they if you look in the Abarbanel, and not just the Abarbanel, people, there's an interpretation that sees that as the first statement that they freed him as separate from the later Gemara, as offering another perspective that is two competing understandings. That's the only way to understand the Abarbanel, the Akedas Yitzchak. I even quoted, who did I quote? One of the Chazan, the Chikrei Lev, as I recalled. He's one of the Poskim Muvhakim in the Sephardic world, is also saying that. Was it him or someone else? Look in our article. So you have these people who, against all convention, have assumed that non-Jews are not obligated in Shem Mitzvah Spanei Noach. And again, what does that mean, not obligated in Shem Mitzvah Spanei Noach? Which mitzvahs? Someone asked me where they can find the Molivar family tree. Good question. Well, we know whose descendants are, some of them, but I don't know about the tree. I'll see if I can find it. And Rabbi Shudnow says that this is a fundamental subject of Eliyahu ben Amozet. Rabbi Professor Chacham Jose Faur emphasizes. I should say to you, since Rabbi Shudnow, you're a student of Faur, they just came out with a volume, 1,500 pages of his, both a volume previously that was published, The Horizontal Society, and two unpublished books. And but you say Professor Chacham Jose Faur, out of all the names that Jose Faur was known by, Rabbi, Professor, and Chacham, he testified that the name he liked most was Chacham. And where did I just see this? I just saw this, that, yes, Yamin Levy. Yeah, I got a whole bunch of books recently, my university library. One of them is from, I sent to Rabbi Kelman, Rabbi Dr. Moshe Sokolow, who does classes on Torah and Motion, because he came out with a new book on Tanakh, and in the preface, he says that a lot of these classes, that a lot of his stuff he's writing about were 35 years of classes at Lincoln Square, and now at Torah and Motion, so he's been teaching for many years. Very interesting book on Pshat. But Yamin Levy, he's a rabbi in the Persian community. He came out with two books on Sephardic sages, one on the Rambam and one on Sephardic sages. And he had a close relationship with Rabbi Faur. And he mentions once he went to Bar Ilan and he was asking, you know, where is Chacham Faur? And the secretary or something didn't know who this Chacham Faur is. So someone walking by said, oh, you mean Professor Faur? And he told Faur the story, and Faur said that he prefers Chacham Faur. Rabbi Shudnow, before you were with us years and years ago, but you can find the Torah in Motion website, and it might even be, I can't remember if they made podcasts out of it, because every week they're coming out podcasts of old classes. We did a few classes on Rabbi Ben Amozik. And if you go online, just Google it, or YouTube, search on YouTube under Shapiro Ben Amozik, I did a class on Rabbi Ben Amozik for there's this group in London called the Chabura, out of the Spanish and Portuguese synagogue. So Rabbi Ben Amozig is actually, we should pronounce his name properly, not like an Ashkenazi, Rabbi Ben Amozig. Rabbi Ben Amozig is a very interesting figure, and Naomi, could it be an influence by Pinsker's auto-emancipation? I assume that that people like Ramolov are influenced by everyone, Moshe Hess, etc. The whole gamut of them, that they realize there's issues going on here, but they don't cite them, though. Moshe says the city of Molev, yes, but that would have been his father, I guess, from the city. Rabbi Shudnow, you mentioned about the Noahai laws, and we'll end with this. Ben Amozig had a student, Palier, and this student came very close to Ben Amozig, and he wanted to convert to Judaism. And Ben Amozig told him, don't convert to Judaism. We need Noahites, and we need to show the world. Mistakenly, and not just the world, Jews mistakenly assume that the Torah is for the Jews. And Rabbi Ben Amozig, a fundamental point of his philosophy is that the Torah, of course, it's for the Jews, but it's not only for the Jews. That the Torah is for the non-Jews also. They just don't know that yet. And Noachidism, the idea of a Noahide covenant, is just as important for the non-Jews as the Torah is for the Jews. And therefore, he convinced Aryeh to remain as a Noahide. I mean, which, with all the restrictions, but with all the benefits. And he lived his life that way. He would go to synagogue, we have reports, but he lived as a Noahide, and he wrote about this. And that's what Rabbi Ben Amozig wanted. Of course, nothing really developed out of it. So Moshe, you say the Torah is for the Jews. The Jews are for the Gentiles. Rav Ben HaMoseg thought differently. Rav Ben HaMoseg thought that the Torah is for the non-Jews also, in the Noahide laws. The Jews have a much more wholesome and complete connection to the Torah, but the Torah is not exclusively to the Jews. Again, you quote the Midrash, okay, the non-Jews didn't accept it, but once the Torah is given, Rav Ben HaMoseg thought that the Torah is designed for the non-Jews also, and we lose out and we sell the Torah short when we portray it as only a document for the Jews, that the Torah speaks to the non-Jews through the Noahide laws. So he's a bit of a proselytizer. You know, Chabad's the same thing, you know, with the Noahide laws at all. But it's I'm just giving you a regalachas here on one foot. Ben HaMoseg is one of the geniuses and the wide-ranging figures in the 19th century. So you'd have to look at his own writings, how he explains it. With that, we've just begun. Next class, really get into it in greater detail. And of course, we're going to look at Rav Moliver's his standings from a halachic angle, his psukim. He has an Arab interesting when it came to the date line, for instance. Rav Moliver was a central figure in this great dispute about the date line. We're going to have to go through the whole Shemitah controversy, Heter Mechira. I don't know if there would have been a Heter Mechira without Rav Moliver. And so we're going to tell the whole story about it. There's a lot to do. It's not going to be 10 classes, Rabbi Kalman, that I know, but it'll be, at least we got a few more classes to Rav Moliver, one of the really great Gedolim. So Rabbi Kalman, take it away.
Yeah, I was looking for the Ben HaMoseg. You know, usually I can find it right away to post in the search bar. I don't know, do you remember when you gave it? I have to go through, you know, I was trying to filter from our library. Anyways, when you spoke about him. But
you just can search on it. When you search on your back, you'll get it.
Spelling wrong. It was spelling
no,
wrong.
I just pulled it up and I'll give the link right now. We have five classes on Rabbi Ben HaMoseg.
Yeah, I don't know why you didn't find it, but okay.
There's a rabbi in Israel. Sorry, I sent it by mistake to someone. I sent it to everyone. Here's the link if anyone wants to see. There's a Rabbi Zinni in Haifa. He fascinating figure. He was a Rav of the Technion. He's really right wing, extremely so. But on the other hand, he's a Francophone, and he's publishing the writings of Ben HaMoseg. And whenever Ben HaMoseg has like a universalistic perspective, in his footnotes he'll say, well, he's led astray but other than the universalism, he loves Ben HaMoseg, and he came out with a new edition of his commentary on Chumash and all sorts of good stuff. So there, I put it in the search box. You plug that in, and you can find the five classes we did in Ben HaMoseg.
Yeah,
we go to Italy this summer, God willing, we'll go to Italy. Now, when Rabbi Kelman came on the trip to Italy last time, we went to Livorno, where Ben HaMoseg lived, and the square in front of the show is called Piazza Ben HaMoseg. Now we don't go. Now we go. We find out that we go to the winery, because people like winery, I guess, more than shoals sometimes. So we're not going back to Livorno, but it's we'll talk about Ben HaMoseg, and we will... I encourage anyone who's interested. Our trips are now up. Morocco, Italy, and a brand new trip. Southern France, south of France, Provence, French Riviera, and lots of Torah, of course, comes from there, and there's a lot to see. So please join us. Bring your friends. Okay, Rabbi Kelman.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, yes, I say the trips are up. We had a whole bunch of registrants over the weekend, so... Okay, Bakasha, look forward to those who can come. They really are unique. It's we have a nice, generally, we have lots of people who've been on many trips, a group together, bonding together, learning. It's for those interested in, you know, in Jewish history, real life, and spend, not to go on vacation.
Let me tell you something, Rabbi Kelman. I don't know if you know, I was in Kemp Mill Synagogue. I was in Silver Spring. I davened in the Kemp Mill Synagogue. I was there for a different reason. But I think Kent Mill Synagogue, I think, has the record for most people on our trips. And I saw lots of our friends there on Shabbos. So people came. I think if you count up the shuls, more people have come from Kent Mill Synagogue than anywhere else, I believe.
I probably come.
Marshall.
Okay. Got it. Anyways, okay. Thank you. Okay. We will have less than 10 classes.
Oh, good.
Now we know. Tomorrow, Rabbi Shulman will give class number 2. He'll have more than 10 classes on Sefer Yehoshua as he continues throughout the year. Just really our second class, that will be tomorrow at 1 p.m. Wednesday, 8:30, Rabbi Helfgott will give... starting in the second half of Yeshua. Those there gave the introduction. We're going to do the second half of Yeshua for the rest of the year. And Parshat HaShavua this week is Sophia Freudenstein. And then my shiur on the Siddur on Friday morning. Next week, Yossi Lendel will be starting a new series on the history of the Siddur. You know, I've been giving class for 3 years on the Siddur itself, and he's going to give a little bit on the history. That will be beginning next Monday, a new series. We'll send out an email about it. And, okay, we look forward to learning with you, and everybody be well. Share good news, and please invite a friend to join us. And Laila Tov. I'm sorry?
Laila Tov.
Laila Tov, Laila Tov. Okay, Vakasha. All right, thank you, everybody. Be well.